This is a recording of a sermon given at the First Unitarian Church of St. Louis.
Once upon a time, or so I am told, a young man joined a Unitarian Universalist church, and after Sunday dinner that evening, his grandfather, who was a renowned professor of history, questioned his grandson's infatuation with such a modern religion. The boy intentionally tried to impress his grandfather with facts that he had specially memorized. "It's not that new, grandfather. 5 U.S. presidents were Unitarians. And Adlai Stevenson was almost the 6th," because he knew his grandfather had liked Adlai Stevenson. "Really?" said the older man with contempt. "Which 5? The young man began counting. "First, there was John Adams." And the grandfather interrupts and, "Which one?" And he had to think, "Both of them." And then there was Thomas Jefferson. And the grandfather said without question, "No, he was an Anglican." "Who else?" The grandson is now completely thrown off balance. He's grasping for names. He's going, "You know, the big fat one." And his grandfather says, "Taft was Chief Justice too." Seeming a little impressed, but then he challenged the grandson again, "And who is the 5th? And the grandson's completely confused now, since the list is all out of order, and grasping and struggling, embarrassed, he says, "Marilyn Fillmore." And realizing his mistake with embarrassment, he looks at the floor, and his grandfather says, "Millard Fillmore is consistently rated one of the worst U.S. presidents ever." And with that and a withering glare, the conversation comes to an abrupt end. Besides the cult of fame that we have in America and a desire to borrow glory from famous persons, why is it that Unitarians, Unitarian Universalists, claim our history and those from our history? And what is our relationship to them? Especially, what is our public theology? We come each for our own individual lives to be nurtured in our hearts and minds and work. But what are we doing in the world? Why is this church here in this city? Do we have any purpose, greater purpose, to serve? And in this time, in these days, when the events in Ferguson have drawn the attention and the conscience and awakened the conscience of the entire nation, and we began to realize that not all is right in this city or in any city, that the high ideals which have guided us have not led us to the end of the journey, and that there is still suffering. What is it that we are called to do as individuals and together? What does this church have to offer in the midst of history and time? What power do we represent? What truths do we embody? Of course, often our public influence has been significant but hidden. For instance, Washington University, named for the first president of the United States. Originally, it was named for William Elliott, minister of this church, but it was finally named for Washington, George Washington. It was created entirely by Unitarians. It was but as an explicitly non-sectarian institution. So much so that 150 years later, I'm told that many people referred to it as the Jewish University in St. Louis. We sometimes do great things, part of serving everyone, not just the Unitarians. We create institutions that serve not just Unitarians, not just Universalists or UUs, but everyone. We want the whole world to be motivated and changed by certain values, and that influence becomes invisible because we don't own it. But at other times, our role in history has been quite ambivalent. The very founding of the Universalist Church of America in the 1790s, it was explicitly stated that the spiritual unity of all human beings, the spiritual union that was granted and offered to all, created obligations of universal love that was incompatible with slavery. The very founding of the Universalist Church of America declared an antagonism to the institution of slavery, and then the Universalist Church did nothing and said nothing for decades and decades. People didn't know what to do with that. They didn't know how to engage in this vast and terrible structure, racist structure that had been at the very heart of the American experiment. The Unitarians had some notable individuals who very quickly got involved, activist people who were involved, and the numbers of those activists who were fighting against slavery were many. Their names too many to be listed here. I hold up that great story of Theodore Parker, Unitarian preacher who kept a gun in the desk where he wrote his sermons because he was also harboring slaves. This was in the 1850s. He was breaking the law. It was an act of conscientious objection. It was an act of civil disobedience to break the law so that some people would be slaved and free, would be saved and freed from slavery. But the Unitarians as a body, they weren't exactly a denomination at that time, but they could never come up with any unified statement, any unified action. And there were many Unitarians who were trying to seek sort of a middle ground or trying to find a way through. There was many who tried to avoid the subject altogether because their wealth, their power, their comfort was built upon the fact of slavery. The institution of slavery allowed them to have the money and power that they had, and they were very ambivalent about changing anything. And then those who knew that to fight the break laws and to go against the institution would cause divisions and pain and warfare and anger and violence, and they did not want violence either. The founder of this church, William Eliot, sought a middle way. He accepted as a necessary evil the Missouri Compromise, which allowed the state to be a slave state, which created the Fugitive Act Law under the Unitarian President Harrison. Eliot understood that to stand too hard on this issue would cause division. He could read the potential strains and difficulties that were coming. He feared the violence and wanted to stop it, and so he tried to find a middle ground, was willing to accept the compromise as a way of bringing people together in a sort of middle way. But at the same time that he failed to directly attack the institution of slavery, though he saw it as wrong, he did not attack it. Instead, what he tried to do was build up institutions in this community, build up institutions of public service and public good for all. Public schools is a perfect example of that. He became the head of the school board in 1848 and found the state of education in the city a miserable mess. A city of about 70,000, only a small fragment of the community's children could get education, and when they did, it was terrible teachers and bad places to learn. So he started to agitate for a public school system. He had learned back in New England when he was in Harvard about the New England model of public education where everyone supported the education of everyone else's children, that we were all in this together. That it wasn't just that some benefited, that all of us benefited from this. But then, in January of 1849, cholera broke out in the city, and people were dying. And people were suffering. And William Eliot spent time holding the hands of those hoping and helping them to grow stronger. And he buried many. And then in May, the spring was just coming. The smell of sweetness on the river. This is, of course, before, you know, mentioned the bridges that were built over the river. This is before the idea of bridges came up. When the heart of the city was still steamboats and the commerce that they brought. And one steamboat catches fire, and pretty soon all of them are on fire, and then buildings in the city, 400 buildings in St. Louis, were destroyed in May. Now, at this point, William Elliott has been doing a lot of work. He really could have said, you know, the school board isn't all that important. But he still believed in education. He still believed in strengthening all the people of this community. And so he started to work for, again, for the tax, to raise a tax, a public tax. Can you imagine trying to raise the taxes now? Raise a tax so that all the children of the city would get education. Of course, he didn't quite address the slavery and segregation issue, so it was all the white children at that point. But he understood the vision, and the members of this congregation were called to help him. They went door to door, and of the few people of the city who came out to vote, overwhelmingly, they chose to establish public education. Instead of fighting the evil institution of slavery, he built up institutions of education and faith and public good. Still, the Civil War was rolling forward, coming closer, unwanted and feared. I'm speaking of Elliott today because this is the day each year that the T.S. Elliott Society meets in our city and in our building. Thomas Stearns Eliot is remembered internationally, not just as a poet and an inspiration for the musical Cats. His greatest contributions to Western civilization, Western letters, was as a critic and as an intellectual, as an essayist, a man of letters. Of course, in this congregation, he's remembered as a child of this church, though he never actually worshipped in this particular building. He was a child of this church and the most famous grandson of our founder. Now, it's notable that much of the historical resonance and significance and power of Unitarians in the time of either of the Elliots was when it was a more explicitly Christian organization. People of this church challenged others about what it meant to be a follower of Jesus, what it meant to bear the name Christian. It's interesting to note that that T.S. Eliot actually moved from being Unitarian to being Anglican, more even heavily Orthodox in his Christianity, more Trinitarian, during the very time that the Unitarian movement was becoming much more pluralistic, much more secular, more non-theistic and diverse, less explicitly Christian. T.S. Eliot was a scholar, and he had found something missing in the Unitarianism of his childhood, and especially the world of business and banking, which was the world of his father and the world of his young adulthood. As a writer and a critic, T.S. Eliot engaged and found the life of the mind. And he found this ancient tradition of thought. Went back to the poets before even Shakespeare and found this lineage of thought, a line of thought that nurtured his soul and his mind. But always he remembered the lessons of his childhood. When he came to Washington University, he gave a speech, famous speech, and which he evoked the duty that came from his grandfather, which was called the law, which he called the law of public service. It's a very good beginning for any child to be brought up with reverence for such institutions and to be taught that personal and selfish aims should be subordinated to the general good which they represent. He jokingly said that this law translated for him into an uncomfortable and very inconvenient obligation to serve upon committees. Sometimes there are people in this church, like Rennie Shooter, who found that inconvenient obligation. The church, for him, he focused on this law of service, the law of service to be played out in three arenas. One was the church, one was the university, and one was the city. And for him, in his childhood, for Eliot, the church was the Church of the Messiah, the Unitarian Church. The university was University of Washington, which was closer to downtown, not on the Danforth campus then, and the city was St. Louis, whose furthest boundaries was Forest Park. And he said, beyond that was just the Wild West. So all of you who live out in the Wild West, I want you to realize where you live. As he moved through his life, he expanded. He never rejected Unitarianism. He just expanded on it. The church became the Church of England, the city of his childhood and the city of his adulthood somehow merged. And even the faith that he carried forward merged. In that poem, you can hear he refers to the river. Some people assume that that river was the River Thames, which he lived near in London, not realizing it was St. Louis, merged together, blended together, flowing as one through his soul, the unitary God and the Trinitary God together. He became an Anglican in part, not only because of the literary history of England and intellectual history of England and just the political history, but also because there was something about Anglicanism which was referred to as the Via Media, the middle way. That middle way was not meant as a third alternative against two other opposites, but was seen as an overlapping. On one side, there was the extreme of Protestantism, in its fullest form, iconoclastic and spare. And on the other side was Catholicism. And Anglicans saw themselves as trying to hold a middle ground that brought the two back together. Anglicans were giving an alternative, not so much an alternative, but a place where there was a comfort with the ambiguity of tensions between these two alternatives, where there was a resistance to the dogmatism that could define both extremes. It was seen as a sort of coalescing of a theological mooring in the ground, and so it sounds very much like Unitarian Universalism today, a seeking to integrate and pull together and find unity. So very much like his grandfather, William Eliot's grandson was seeking a middle way between those who would be radical and their opposition theologically of certain ideas and those who would be radically conservative on the other hand, those who would do nothing and those who would do everything. He's trying to seek that middle way. And that was at a time when the world was rolling towards World War II, when the divisions and the tensions were still very present. There was a moment where one critic asked 149 writers in Europe and in America about their stance on the civil war in Spain, where fascism was becoming present, becoming an alternative to dictatorships. And the person who sent out the call demanded that people choose one side or another. And there were only three people who failed to choose a side. And one of those was T.S. Eliot, who said, "I'm naturally sympathetic to those who want to throw off dictatorships, but I cannot stand fully with the rebels, with Franco." And so there was this seeking of trying to find a middle way of avoiding the violence. And today, in this city, in this place, which has become a symbol of the conscience of all of America, we must ask ourselves, what is it that we want to do? What is it that we are demanded and called to do? There are some of us, I've heard members of this congregation, who say we should do something every day. Every day we should be out there demanding change, not just focusing on the moment of Michael Brown and his death, but all the problems that have been raised up that still need to be undone in this city. And there are other people who are saying we need to honor those who are trying to keep peace, those who are trying to keep order. We cannot let things run out of control. We cannot have violence and rioting. for that will cause deeper pain and deeper division. Where do you stand? I do not tell you that one way or the other or the middle is the right way. I do not tell you that you must be an activist, ardent, and protesting. I do not tell you that you should simply nurture your own heart and your own goodness. I do not tell you that you need to seek a middle way. I'm certainly not telling you to be an Anglican, though that's a good thing. I'd like you to be the best Unitarian Universalists and part of Unitarian Universal that you can. And the part of Unitarian Universalism is that vision of the beloved community where justice reigns over all. A community where lesbian or gay or bisexual or transgender people are not stuck off in a little category, the LGBTQ community, but they are simply who they are, human beings in and amongst a community of human beings able to be healthy and part of a larger society. It's not where ethnicities are alienated and isolated, but where all the ethnicities, all the different identities come together and we are able to be ourselves, not where we're colorblind, but where we honor and celebrate the differences, the beautiful colors of all humanity. That vision of that community that is in harmony with the living things and the web, the web of being, the web of life that sustains and overarches all. How will we move towards that city? How can we make that city present? For some of us, it is engaging in spiritual discipline so that peace and well-being and open-mindedness and compassion rise up within our individual lives. Some of us, it's working hard to build the institutions of the city to be the best that they can be, to make the world in which people are struggling for justice a world where justice is at least possible. And for some of us, it means rattling the cages. It means identifying with those who daily have to face the pain of racism, who have to face the oppression of hatred and misunderstanding and being trapped in categories, to speak out. Some of us need to support the police, and some of us need to support the protesters. But all of us need to move towards that glorious golden city evoked in the vision of ancient times and still living in our hearts today. As spiritual grandchildren of William Eliot, what shall we do in this time, in this place?
You have been listening to a sermon recorded at the First Unitarian Church of St. Louis.